and neurotransmitter produced by the hypothalamus. Oxytocin is widely used among vertebrates to prepare females for motherhood. In mammals, it causes uterine contractions and milk letdown, as well as a powerful motivation to touch and care for one's children. Evolution has often reused oxytocin to forge other kinds of bonds. In species in which males stick by their mates or protect their own offspring, it's because male brains were slightly modified to be more responsive to oxytocin. In people, oxytocin reaches far beyond family life. If you squirt oxytocin spray into a person's nose, he or she will be more trusting in a game that involves transferring money temporarily to an anonymous partner. Conversely, people who behave trustingly cause oxytocin levels to increase in the partner they trusted. Oxytocin levels also rise when people watch videos about other people suffering, at least among those who report feelings of empathy and a desire to help. Your brain secretes more oxytocin when you have intimate contact with another person, even if that contact is just a back rub from a stranger. What a lovely hormone! It's no wonder the press has swooned in recent years, dubbing it the love drug and the cuddle hormone. If we could put oxytocin into the world's drinking water, might there be an end to war and cruelty? Unfortunately, no. If the hive switch is a product of group selection, then it should show the signature feature of group selection, parochial altruism. Oxytocin should bond us to our partners and our groups so that we can more effectively compete with other groups. It should not bond us to humanity in general. Several recent studies have validated this prediction. In one set of studies, Dutch men played a variety of economic games while sitting alone in cubicles linked via computers into small teams. Half of the men had been given a nasal spray of oxytocin, and half got a placebo spray. The men who received oxytocin made less selfish decisions. They cared more about helping their group, but they showed no concern at all for improving the outcomes of men in the other groups. In one of these studies, oxytocin made men more willing to hurt other teams in a prisoner's dilemma game because doing so was the best way to protect their own group. In a set of follow-up studies, the authors found that oxytocin caused Dutch men to like Dutch names more and to value saving Dutch lives more in trolley-type dilemmas. Over and over again, the researchers looked for signs that this increased in-group love would be paired with increased out-group hate towards Muslims, but they failed to find it. Oxytocin simply makes people love their in-group more. It makes them parochial altruists. The authors conclude that their findings, quote, provide evidence for the idea that neurobiological mechanisms in general and oxytocinergic systems in particular evolved to sustain and facilitate within-group coordination and cooperation, end quote. The second candidate for sustaining within-group coordination is the mirror neuron system. Mirror neurons were discovered accidentally in the 1980s when a team of Italian scientists began inserting tiny electrodes into individual neurons in the brains of macaque monkeys. The researchers were trying to find out what some individual cells were doing in a region of the cerebral cortex that they knew controls fine motor movements. They discovered that there were some neurons that fired rapidly only when the monkey made a very specific movement, such as grasping a nut between thumb and forefinger, versus, say, grabbing the nut with the entire hand. But once they had these electrodes implanted and hooked up to a speaker so that they could hear the rate of firing, they began to hear firing noises at odd times, such as when a monkey was perfectly still and it was the researcher who had just picked up something with his thumb and forefinger. This made no sense because perception and action were supposed to occur in separate regions of the brain. Yet here were neurons that didn't care whether the monkey was doing something or watching someone else do it. The monkey seemed to mirror the actions of others in the same part of its brain that it would use to do those actions itself. Later work demonstrated that most mirror neurons fire not when they see a specific physical movement, but when they see an action that indicates a more general goal or intention. For example, watching a video of a hand picking up a cup from a clean table, as if to bring it to the person's mouth, triggers a mirror neuron for eating. But the exact same hand movement and the exact same cup, picked up from a messy table where a meal seems to be finished, triggers a different mirror neuron for picking things up in general. The monkeys have neural systems that infer the intentions of others, which is clearly a prerequisite for Tomasello's shared intentionality. But they aren't yet ready to share. Mirror neurons seem designed for the monkey's own private use, either to help them learn from others or to help them predict what another monkey will do next. In humans, the mirror neuron system is found in brain regions that correspond directly to those studied in macaques. But in humans, the mirror neurons have a much stronger connection to emotion-related areas of the brain, first to the insular cortex, and from there to the amygdala and other limbic areas. People feel each other's pain and joy to a much greater degree than do any other primates. Just seeing someone else smile activates some of the same neurons as when you smile. The other person is effectively smiling in your brain, which makes you happy and likely to smile, which in turn passes the smile into someone else's brain. Mirror neurons are perfectly suited for Durkheim's collective sentiments, particularly the emotional electricity of collective effervescence. But their Durkheimian nature comes out even more clearly in a study led by the neuroscientist Tanya Singer. Subjects first played an economic game with two strangers, one of whom played nicely while the other played selfishly. In the next part of the study, subjects' brains were scanned while mild electric shocks were delivered randomly to the hand of the subject, the hand of the nice player, or the hand of the selfish player. The other player's hands were visible to the subject, near her own, while she was in the scanner. Results showed that subjects' brains responded in the same way when the nice player received a shock as when they themselves were shocked. The subjects used their mirror neurons, empathized, and felt the other's pain. But when the selfish player got a shock, people showed less empathy, and some even showed neural evidence of pleasure. In other words, people don't just blindly empathize. They don't sync up with everyone they see. We are conditional hive creatures. We are more likely to mirror and then empathize with others when they have conformed to our moral matrix than when they have violated it. Hives at work. From cradle to grave, we are surrounded by corporations and things made by corporations. What exactly are corporations, and how do they come to cover the earth? The word itself comes from corpus, Latin for body. A corporation is, quite literally, a superorganism. Here's an early definition from Stuart Kidd's 1794 Treatise on the Law of Corporations. A corporation is, quote, a collection of many individuals united into one body, under a special denomination, having perpetual succession under an artificial form, and vested by policy of the law with the capacity of acting in several respects as an individual, end quote. This legal fiction, recognizing a collection of many individuals as a new kind of individual, turned out to be a winning formula. It let people place themselves into a new kind of boat within which they could divide labor, suppress free riding, and take on gigantic tasks with the potential for gigantic rewards. Corporations and corporate law helped England pull out ahead of the rest of the world in the early days of the Industrial Revolution. As with the transition to beehives and city-states, it took a while for the new superorganisms to work out the kinks, perfect the form, and develop effective defenses against external attacks and internal subversion. But once those problems were addressed, there was explosive growth. During the 20th century, small businesses got pushed to the margins or to extinction as corporations dominated the most lucrative markets. Corporations are now so powerful that only national governments can restrain the largest of them, and even then, it's only some governments and some of the time. It is possible to build a corporation staffed entirely by Homo economicus. The gains from cooperation and division of labor are so vast that large companies can pay more than small businesses and then use a series of institutionalized carrots and sticks, including expensive monitoring and enforcement mechanisms, to motivate self-serving employees to act in ways the company desires. But this approach, sometimes called transactional leadership, has its limits. Self-interested employees are Glauconians, far more interested in looking good and getting promoted than in helping the company. In contrast, an organization that takes advantage of our hivish nature can activate pride, loyalty, and enthusiasm among its employees and then monitor them less closely. This approach to leadership, sometimes called transformational leadership, generates more social capital, The bonds of trust that help employees get more work done at a lower cost than employees at other firms. Hivish employees work harder, have more fun, and are less likely to quit or sue the company. Unlike Homo economicus, they are truly team players. What can leaders do to create more hivish organizations? The first step is to stop thinking so much about leadership. One group of scholars has used multi-level selection to think about what leadership really is. Robert Hogan, Robert Kaiser, and Mark Van Vught argue that leadership can only be understood as the complement of followership. Focusing on leadership alone is like trying to understand clapping by studying only the left hand. They point out that leadership is not even the more interesting hand. It's no puzzle to understand why people want to lead. The real puzzle is why people are willing to follow. These scholars note that people evolved to live in groups of up to 150 that were relatively egalitarian and wary of alpha males, as Chris Bohm said. But we also evolve the ability to rally around leaders when our group is under threat or is competing with other groups. Remember how the Rattlers and the Eagles instantly became more tribal and hierarchical the instant they discovered the presence of the other group? Research also shows that strangers will spontaneously organize themselves into leaders and followers when natural disasters strike. People are happy to follow when they see that their group needs to get something done, and when the person who emerges as the leader doesn't activate their hypersensitive oppression detectors. A leader must construct a moral matrix based in some way on the authority foundation to legitimize the authority of the leader, the liberty foundation to make sure that subordinates don't feel oppressed and don't want to band together to oppose a bullying alpha male, and above all, the loyalty foundation, which I defined in Chapter 7 as a response to the challenge of forming cohesive coalitions. Using this evolutionary framework, we can draw some direct lessons for anyone who wants to make a team, company, school, or other organization more hivish, happy, and productive. You don't need to slip ecstasy into the water cooler and then throw a rave party in the cafeteria. The hive switch may be more of a slider switch than an on-off switch. And with a few institutional changes, you can create environments that will nudge everyone's sliders a bit closer to the hive position. For example, 1. Increase similarity, not diversity. To make a human hive, you want to make everyone feel like a family. So don't call attention to racial and ethnic differences. Make them less relevant by ramping up similarity and celebrating the group's shared values and common identity. A great deal of research in social psychology shows that people are warmer and more trusting toward people who look like them, dress like them, talk like them, or even just share their first name or birthday. There's nothing special about race. You can make people care less about race by drowning race differences in a sea of similarities, shared goals, and mutual interdependencies. 2. Exploit synchrony. People who move together are saying, "We are one, we are a team. Just look how perfectly we were able to do that Tomasello shared intention thing." Japanese corporations such as Toyota begin their days with synchronous company-wide exercises. Groups prepare for battle, in war and sports, with group chants and ritualized movements. If you want to see an impressive one in rugby, Google All Blacks Haka, H-A-K-A. If you ask people to sing a song together, or to march in step, or just to tap out some beats together on a table, it makes them trust each other more and be more willing to help each other out, in part because it makes people feel more similar to each other. If it's too creepy to ask your employees or fellow group members to do synchronized calisthenics, perhaps you can just try to have more parties with dancing or karaoke. Synchrony builds trust. 3. Create healthy competition among teams, not individuals. As McNeil said, soldiers don't risk their lives for their country or for the army. They do so for their buddies in the same squad or platoon. Studies show that intergroup competition increases love of the in-group far more than it increases dislike of the out-group. Intergroup competitions, such as friendly rivalries between corporate divisions or intramural sports competitions, should have a net positive effect on hivishness and social capital. But pitting individuals against each other in a competition for scarce resources, such as bonuses, will destroy hivishness, trust, and morale. Much more could be said about leading a hivish organization. Kaiser and Hogan offer this summary of the research literature. Quote, transactional leadership appeals to followers' self-interest, but transformational leadership changes the way followers see themselves, from isolated individuals to members of a larger group. Transformational leaders do this by modeling collective commitment, for example, through self-sacrifice and the use of we rather than I, emphasizing the similarity of group members, and reinforcing collective goals, shared values, and common interests. End quote. In other words, transformational leaders understand, at least implicitly, that human beings have a dual nature. They set up organizations that engage, to some degree, the higher level of that nature. Good leaders create good followers, but followership in a hivish organization is better described as membership. Political hives. Great leaders understand Durkheim, even if they've never read his work. For Americans born before 1950, you can activate their Durkheimian higher nature by saying just two words, ask not. The full sentence they'll hear in their minds comes from John F. Kennedy's 1961 inaugural address. After calling on all Americans to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, that is, to pay the costs and take the risks of fighting the Cold War against the Soviet Union, Kennedy delivered one of the most famous lines in American history. Quote, and so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. End quote. The yearning to serve something larger than the self has been the basis of so many modern political movements. Here's another brilliantly Durkheimian appeal. Quote, our movement rejects the view of man as an individual, standing by himself, self-centered, subject to natural law, which instinctively urges him toward a life of selfish, momentary pleasure. It sees not only the individual, but the nation and the country, individuals and generations bound together by a moral law, with common traditions, and a mission which, suppressing the instinct for life closed in a brief circle of pleasure, builds up a higher life founded on duty, a life free from the limitations of time and space, in which the individual, by self-sacrifice, the renunciation of self-interest, can achieve that purely spiritual existence in which his value as a man consists. End quote. Inspiring stuff, until you learn that it's from The Doctrine of Fascism by Benito Mussolini. Fascism is hive psychology scaled up to grotesque heights. It's the doctrine of the nation as a superorganism, within which the individual loses all importance. So hive psychology is bad stuff, right? Any leader who tries to get people to forget themselves and merge into a team pursuing a common goal is flirting with fascism, no? Asking your employees to exercise together, isn't that the sort of thing Hitler did at his Nuremberg rallies? Ehrenreich devotes a chapter of Dancing in the Streets to refuting this concern. She notes that ecstatic dancing is an evolved biotechnology for dissolving hierarchy and bonding people to each other as a community. Ecstatic dancing, festivals, and carnivals invariably erase or invert the hierarchies of everyday life. Men dress as women, peasants pretend to be nobles, and leaders can be safely mocked. When it's all over and people have returned to their normal social stations, those stations are a bit less rigid, and the connections among people in different stations are a bit warmer. Fascist rallies, Ehrenreich notes, were nothing like this. They were spectacles, not festivals. They used awe to strengthen hierarchy and to bond people to the godlike figure of the leader. People at fascist rallies didn't dance, and they surely didn't mock their leaders. They stood around passively for hours, applauding when groups of soldiers marched by, or cheering wildly when the dear leader arrived and spoke to them. Fascist dictators clearly exploited many aspects of humanity's groupish psychology. But is that a valid reason for us to shun or fear the hive switch? Hiving comes naturally, easily, and joyfully to us. Its normal function is to bond dozens or at most hundreds of people together into communities of trust, cooperation, and even love. Those bonded groups may care less about outsiders than they did before their bonding. The nature of group selection is to suppress selfishness within groups to make them more effective at competing with other groups. But is that really such a bad thing overall? given how shallow our care for strangers is in the first place? Might the world be a better place if we could greatly increase the care people get within their existing groups and nations while slightly decreasing the care they get from strangers in other groups and nations? Let's imagine two nations, one full of small-scale hives, one devoid of them. In the hivish nation, let's suppose that most people participate in several cross-cutting hives, perhaps one at work, one at church, and one in a weekend sports league. At universities, most students join fraternities and sororities. In the workplace, most leaders structure their organizations to take advantage of our groupish overlay. Throughout their lives, citizens regularly enjoy muscular bonding, team building, and moments of self-transcendence with groups of fellow citizens who may be different from them racially, but with whom they feel deep similarity and interdependence. This bonding is often accompanied by the excitement of intergroup competition, as in sports and business, but sometimes not, as in church. In the second nation, there's no hiving at all. Everyone cherishes their autonomy and respects the autonomy of their fellow citizens. Groups form only to the extent that they advance the interests of their members. Businesses are led by transactional leaders who align the material incentives of employees as closely as possible with the interests of the company, so that if everyone pursues their self-interest, the business will thrive. In this non-hivish nation, you'll find families and plenty of friendships. You'll find altruism, both kin and reciprocal. You'll find all the stuff described by evolutionary psychologists who doubt that group selection occurred, but you'll find no evidence of group-related adaptations such as the hive switch. You'll find no culturally approved or institutionalized ways to lose yourself in a larger group. Which nation do you think would score higher on measures of social capital, mental health, and happiness? Which nation will produce more successful businesses and a higher standard of living? When a single hive is scaled up to the size of a nation and is led by a dictator with an army at his disposal, the results are invariably disastrous. But that is no argument for removing or suppressing hives at lower levels. In fact, a nation that is full of hives is a nation of happy and satisfied people. It is not a very promising target for takeover by a demagogue offering people meaning in exchange for their souls. Creating a nation of multiple competing groups and parties was, in fact, seen by America's founding fathers as a way of preventing tyranny. More recently, research on social capital has demonstrated that bowling leagues, churches, and other kinds of groups, teams, and clubs are crucial for the health of individuals and of a nation. As political scientist Robert Putnam put it, the social capital that is generated by such local groups makes us smarter, healthier, safer, richer, and better able to govern a just and stable democracy. A nation of individuals, in contrast, in which citizens spend all their time in Durkheim's lower level, is likely to be hungry for meaning. If people can't satisfy their need for deep connection in other ways, they'll be more receptive to a smooth-talking leader who urges them to renounce their lives of selfish momentary pleasure and follow him onward to that purely spiritual existence in which their value as human beings consists. In sum, when I began writing the happiness hypothesis, I believed that happiness came from within, as Buddha and the Stoic philosophers said thousands of years ago. You'll never make the world conform to your wishes, so focus on changing yourself and your desires. But by the time I finished writing, I had changed my mind. Happiness comes from between. It comes from getting the right relationships between yourself and others, yourself and your work, and yourself and something larger than yourself. Once you understand our dual nature, including our groupish overlay, you can see why happiness comes from between. We evolved to live in groups. Our minds were designed not only to help us win the competition within our groups, but also to help us unite with those in our groups to win competitions across groups. In this chapter, I presented the hive hypothesis, which states that human beings are conditional hive creatures. We have the ability, under special circumstances, to transcend self-interest and lose ourselves, temporarily and ecstatically, in something larger than ourselves. I called this ability the hive switch. The hive switch is another way of stating Durkheim's idea that we are homo duplex. We live most of our lives in the ordinary, profane world. but we achieve our greatest joys in those brief moments of transit to the sacred world in which we become simply a part of a whole. I described three common ways in which people flip the hive switch: awe in nature, Durkheimian drugs, and raves. I described recent findings about oxytocin and mirror neurons that suggest that they are the stuff of which the hive switch is made. Oxytocin bonds people to their groups, not to all of humanity. Mirror neurons help people empathize with others, but particularly those that share their moral matrix. It would be nice to believe that we humans were designed to love everyone unconditionally. Nice, but rather unlikely from an evolutionary perspective. Parochial love, love within groups, amplified by similarity, a sense of shared fate, and the suppression of free riders, may be the most we can accomplish. Chapter 11. Religion is a team sport. Every Saturday in the fall, at colleges across the United States, millions of people pack themselves into stadiums to participate in a ritual that can only be described as tribal. At the University of Virginia, the ritual begins in the morning as students dress in special costumes. Men wear dress shirts with UVA neckties, and if the weather is warm, shorts. Women typically wear skirts or dresses, sometimes with pearl necklaces. Some students paint the logo of our sports teams, the Cavaliers, a V crossed by two swords, on their faces or other body parts. The students attend pre-game parties that serve brunch and alcoholic drinks. Then they stream over to the stadium, sometimes stopping to mingle with friends, relatives, or unknown alumni who have driven for hours to reach Charlottesville in time to set up tailgate parties in every parking lot within a half mile of the stadium. More food, more alcohol, more face painting. By the time the game starts, many of the 50,000 fans are drunk, which makes it easier for them to overcome self-consciousness and participate fully in the synchronous chants, cheers, jeers, and songs that will fill the next 3 hours. Every time the Cavaliers score, the students sing the same song UVA students have sung together on such occasions for over a century. The first verse comes straight out of Durkheim and Ehrenreich. The students literally lock arms and sway as a single mass while singing the praises of their community to the tune of Auld Lang Syne. That good old song of Wah-hoo-wah, we'll sing it o'er and o'er. It cheers our hearts and warms our blood to hear them shout and roar. We come from old Virginia, where all is bright and gay. Let's all join hands and give a yell for dear old UVA. Next, the students illustrate McNeil's thesis that muscular bonding warms people up for coordinated military action. The students let go of each other's arms and make aggressive fist-pumping motions in the air in sync with a nonsensical battle chant. Wah-hoo-wah, wah-hoo-wah, Univ-Virginia, hoorah-ray, hoorah-ray, ray-ray, UVA. It's a whole day of hiving and collective emotions. Collective effervescence is guaranteed, as are feelings of collective outrage at questionable calls by the referees, collective triumph if the team wins, and collective grief if the team loses, followed by more collective drinking at post-game parties. Why do the students sing, chant, dance, sway, chop, and stomp so enthusiastically during the game? Showing support for their football team may help to motivate the players, but is that the function of these behaviors? Are they done in order to achieve victory? No. From a Durkheimian perspective, these behaviors serve a very different function, and it is the same one that Durkheim saw at work in most religious rituals: the creation of a community. A college football game is a superb analogy for religion. From a naive perspective, focusing only on what is most visible, that is, the game being played on the field, college football is an extravagant, costly, wasteful institution that impairs people's ability to think rationally while leaving a long trail of victims, including the players themselves, plus the many fans who suffer alcohol-related injuries. But from a sociologically informed perspective, it is a religious rite that does just what it is supposed to do. It pulls people up from Durkheim's lower level, the profane, to his higher level, the sacred. It flips the hive switch and makes people feel, for a few hours, that they are simply a part of a whole. It augments the school spirit for which UVA is renowned, which in turn attracts better students and more alumni donations, which in turn improves the experience for the entire community, including professors like me, who have no interest in sports. Religions are social facts. Religion cannot be studied in lone individuals any more than hivishness can be studied in lone bees. Durkheim's definition of religion makes its binding function clear. Quote, "A religion is a unified system of beliefs and practices relative to sacred things, that is to say, things set apart and forbidden, beliefs and practices which unite into one single moral community called a church, all those who adhere to them." End quote. In this chapter, I continue exploring the third principle of moral psychology: morality binds and blinds. Many scientists misunderstand religion because they ignore this principle and examine only what is most visible. They focus on individuals and their supernatural beliefs rather than on groups and their binding practices. They conclude that religion is an extravagant, costly, wasteful institution that impairs people's ability to think rationally while leaving a long trail of victims. I do not deny that religions do, at times, fit that description. But if we are to render a fair judgment about religion and understand its relationship to morality and politics, we must first describe it accurately. The Lone Believer. When 19 Muslims hijacked 4 planes and used them to destroy the World Trade Center and a section of the Pentagon, they forced into the open a belief that many in the Western world had harbored since the 1980s, that there is a special connection between Islam and terrorism. Commentators on the right were quick to blame Islam. Commentators on the left were just as quick to say that Islam is a religion of peace and that the blame should be placed on fundamentalism. But an interesting rift opened up on the left. Some scientists, whose politics were otherwise quite liberal, began to attack not just Islam, but all religions other than Buddhism. After decades of culture war in the United States over the teaching of evolution in public schools, some scientists saw little distinction between Islam and Christianity. All religions, they said, are delusions that prevent people from embracing science, secularism, and modernity. The horror of 9/11 motivated several of these scientists to write books, and between 2004 and 2007, so many such books were published that a movement was born, the New Atheism. The titles were combative. The first one out was Sam Harris's The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason, followed by Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, Daniel Dennett's Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, and, with the most explicit title of all, Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. These four authors are known as the Four Horsemen of New Atheism, but I'm going to set Hitchens aside because he is a journalist whose book made no pretense to be anything other than a polemical diatribe. The other three authors, however, are men of science. Harris was a graduate student in neuroscience at the time, Dawkins is a biologist, and Dennett is a philosopher who has written widely on evolution. These three authors claim to speak for science and to exemplify the values of science, particularly its open-mindedness and its insistence that claims be grounded in reason and empirical evidence, not faith and emotion. I also group these three authors together because they offer similar definitions of religion, all focusing on belief in supernatural agents. Here is Harris. Quote, "Throughout this book, I am criticizing faith in its ordinary, scriptural sense, as belief in and life orientation toward certain historical and metaphysical propositions." End quote. Harris's own research examines what happens in the brain when people believe or disbelieve various propositions, and he justifies his focus on religious belief with this psychological claim. Quote, "A belief is a lever that, once pulled, moves almost everything else in a person's life." End quote. For Harris, beliefs are the key to understanding the psychology of religion, because in his view, believing a falsehood, such as that martyrs will be rewarded with 72 virgins in heaven, makes religious people do harmful things, such as suicide bombing. I've illustrated Harris's psychological model in Figure 11.1, which shows two circles. The first has the word believing in it, pointing with an arrow to the word doing. Dawkins takes a similar approach. He defines the God hypothesis as the proposition that, quote, there exists a superhuman, supernatural intelligence who deliberately designed and created the universe and everything in it, including us, end quote. The rest of the book is an argument that, quote, God, in the sense defined, is a delusion and, as later chapters will show, a pernicious delusion, end quote. Once again, religion is studied as a set of beliefs about supernatural agents, and these beliefs are said to be the cause of a wide range of harmful actions. Dennett takes that approach too. Supernatural agents do, of course, play a central role in religion, just as the actual football is at the center of the whirl of activity on game day at UVA. But trying to understand the persistence and passion of religion by studying beliefs about God is like trying to understand the persistence and passion of college football by studying the movements of the ball. You've got to broaden the inquiry. You've got to look at the ways that religious beliefs work with religious practices to create a religious community. Believing, doing, and belonging are three complementary yet distinct aspects of religiosity, according to many scholars. When you look at all three aspects at the same time, you get a view of the psychology of religion that's very different from the view of the new atheists. I'll call this competing model the Durkheimian model because it says that the function of those beliefs and practices is ultimately to create a community. Often, our beliefs are post hoc constructions designed to justify what we've just done or to support the groups we belong to. Figure 11.2 shows the Durkheimian model of religious psychology. It's just three circles, one with the word believing, one with the word belonging, one with the word doing. The three circles are each joined by bidirectional arrows. The new atheist model is based on the Platonic rationalist view of the mind, which I introduced in Chapter 2. Reason is, or at least could be, the charioteer guiding the passions, the horses. So as long as reason has the proper factual beliefs and has control of the unruly passions, the chariot will go in the right direction. In chapters 2, 3, and 4, however, I reviewed a great deal of evidence against the Platonic view and in favor of a Humean view, in which reason, the rider, is a servant of the intuitions, the elephant. Let's continue the debate between rationalism and social intuitionism as we examine religion. To understand the psychology of religion, should we focus on the false beliefs and faulty reasoning of individual believers? Or should we focus on the automatic, intuitive processes of people embedded in social groups that are striving to create a moral community? That depends on what we think religion is and where we think it came from. The New Atheist Story: Byproducts, Then Parasites. To an evolutionist, religious behaviors stand out like peacocks in a sunlit glade, as Dennett put it. Evolution ruthlessly eliminates costly and wasteful behaviors from an animal's repertoire over many generations. Yet, to quote Dawkins, no known culture lacks some version of the time-consuming, wealth-consuming, hostility-provoking rituals, the anti-factual, counterproductive fantasies of religion. To resolve this puzzle, either you have to grant that religiosity is, or at least used to be, beneficial, or you have to construct a complicated, multi-step explanation of how humans in all known cultures came to swim against the tide of adaptation and do so much self-destructive religious stuff. The new atheists choose the latter course. Their accounts all begin with a discussion of multiple evolutionary byproducts that explain the accidental origin of God beliefs, and some then continue on to an account of how these beliefs evolved as sets of parasitic memes. The first step in the new atheist story, one that I won't challenge, is the hypersensitive agency detection device. The idea makes a lot of sense. We see faces in the clouds, but never clouds in faces, because we have special cognitive modules for face detection. The face detector is on a hair trigger, and it makes almost all of its mistakes in one direction, false positives, that is, seeing a face when no real face is present, rather than false negatives, that is, failing to see a face that really is present. Similarly, most animals confront the challenge of distinguishing events that are caused by the presence of another animal, an agent that can move under its own power, from those that are caused by the wind, or a pine cone falling, or anything else that lacks agency. The solution to this challenge is an agency detection module, and, like a face detector, it's on a hair trigger. It makes almost all of its mistakes in one direction, false positives, that is, detecting an agent when none is present, rather than false negatives, that is, failing to detect the presence of a real agent. If you want to see the hypersensitive agency detector in action, just slide your fist around under a blanket within sight of a puppy or a kitten. If you want to know why it's on a hair trigger, just think about which kind of error would be more costly the next time you are walking alone at night in the deep forest or a dark alley. The hypersensitive agency detection device is finely tuned to maximize survival, not accuracy. But now, suppose that early humans, equipped with a hypersensitive agency detector, a new ability to engage in shared intentionality, and a love of stories, begin to talk about their many misperceptions. Suppose they begin attributing agency to the weather. Thunder and lightning sure make it seem as though somebody up in the sky is angry at us. Suppose a group of humans begins jointly creating a pantheon of invisible agents who cause the weather and other assorted cases of good or bad fortune. Voila! The birth of supernatural agents, not as an adaptation for anything, but as a byproduct of a cognitive module that is otherwise highly adaptive. For a more mundane example of a byproduct, think about the bridge of the nose as an anatomical feature useful for holding up eyeglasses. It evolved for other reasons, but we humans reuse it for an entirely new purpose. Now, repeat this sort of analysis on 5 or 10 more traits. Dawkins proposes a gullible learning module. Quote, "There will be a selective advantage to child brains that possess the rule of thumb, believe without question whatever your grown-ups tell you." End quote. Dennett suggests that the circuitry for falling in love has gotten commandeered by some religions to make people fall in love with God. The developmental psychologist Paul Bloom has shown that our minds were designed for dualism. We think that minds and bodies are different but equally real sorts of things, and so we readily believe that we have immortal souls housed in our temporary bodies. In all cases, the logic is the same. A bit of mental machinery evolved because it conferred a real benefit, but the machinery sometimes misfires, producing accidental cognitive effects that make people prone to believing in gods. At no point was religion itself beneficial to individuals or groups. At no point were genes selected because individuals or groups who were better at godding outcompeted those who failed to produce, fear, or love their gods. According to these theorists, the genes for constructing these various modules were all in place by the time modern humans left Africa, and the genes did not change in response to selection pressures, either for or against religiosity, during the 50,000 years since then. The gods changed, however, and this brings us to the second step of the New Atheist story, cultural evolution. Once people began to believe in supernatural agents, and to talk about them, and transmit them to their children, the race was on. But the race was not run by people or genes. It was a race among the various supernatural concepts that people generated. As Dennett put it, quote, "The memorable nymphs and fairies and goblins and demons that crowd the mythologies of every people are the imaginative offspring of a hyperactive habit of finding agency wherever anything puzzles or frightens us. This mindlessly generates a vast overpopulation of agent ideas, most of which are too stupid to hold our attention for an instant. Only a well-designed few make it through the rehearsal tournament, mutating and improving as they go. The ones that get shared and remembered are the souped-up winners of billions of competitions for rehearsal time in the brains of our ancestors." End quote. To Dennett and Dawkins, religions are sets of memes that have undergone Darwinian selection. Like biological traits, religions are heritable, they mutate, and there is selection among these mutations. The selection occurs not on the basis of the benefits religions confer upon individuals or groups, but on the basis of their ability to survive and reproduce themselves. Some religions are better than others at hijacking the human mind, burrowing in deeply, and then getting themselves transmitted to the next generation of host minds. Dennett opens Breaking the Spell with the story of a tiny parasite that commandeers the brains of ants, causing them to climb to the tops of blades of grass, where they can more easily be eaten by grazing animals. The behavior is suicide for the ant, but it's adaptive for the parasite, which requires the digestive system of a ruminant to reproduce itself. Dennett proposes that religions survive because, like those parasites, they make their hosts do things that are bad for themselves, such as suicide bombing, but good for the parasite, such as Islam. Dawkins, similarly, describes religions as viruses. Just as a cold virus makes its host sneeze to spread itself, successful religions make their hosts expend precious resources to spread the infection. These analogies have clear implications for social change. If religion is a virus or a parasite that exploits a set of cognitive byproducts for its benefit, not ours, then we ought to rid ourselves of it. Scientists, humanists, and the small number of others who have escaped infection and are still able to reason must work together to break the spell, lift the delusion, and bring about the end of faith. A Better Story: Byproducts, Then Cultural Group Selection. Scientists who are not on the New Atheist team have been far more willing to say that religion might be an adaptation, that is, it might have evolved because it conferred benefits on individuals or groups. The anthropologists Scott Atran and Joe Henrich recently published a paper that tells a more nuanced story about the evolution of religiosity, one that is consistent with a broader set of empirical findings. Like the New Atheists, their story has two steps, and the first step is the same: a diverse set of cognitive modules and abilities, including the hypersensitive agency detector, evolved as adaptations to solve a variety of problems. But they often misfired, producing beliefs, such as in supernatural agents, that then contributed, as byproducts, to the earliest quasi-religious behaviors. These modules were all in place by the time humans began leaving Africa more than 50,000 years ago. As with the New Atheists, this first step was followed by a second step involving cultural, not genetic, evolution. But instead of talking about religions as parasitic memes evolving for their own benefit, Atran and Henrich suggest that religions are sets of cultural innovations that spread to the extent that they make groups more cohesive and cooperative. Atran and Henrich argue that the cultural evolution of religion has been driven largely by competition among groups. Groups that were able to put their byproduct gods to some use had an advantage over groups that failed to do so, and their ideas, not their genes, spread. Groups with less effective religions didn't necessarily get wiped out. Often they just adopted the more effective variations. So it's really the religions that evolved, not the people or their genes. Among the best things to do with a byproduct god, according to Atran and Henrich, is to create a moral community. The gods of hunter-gatherers are often capricious and malevolent. They sometimes punish bad behavior, but they bring suffering to the virtuous as well. As groups take up agriculture and grow larger, however, their gods become far more moralistic. The gods of larger societies are usually quite concerned about actions that foment conflict and division within the group, such as murder, adultery, false witness, and the breaking of oaths. If the gods evolve culturally to condemn selfish and divisive behaviors, they can then be used to promote cooperation and trust within the group. You don't need a social scientist to tell you that people behave less ethically when they think nobody can see them. That was Glaucon's point about the Ring of Gyges, and a great many social scientists have proven him right. For example, people cheat more on a test when the lights are dimmed. They cheat less when there is a cartoon-like image of an eye nearby, or when the concept of God is activated in memory merely by asking people to unscramble sentences that include words related to God. Creating gods who can see everything and who hate cheaters and oath-breakers turns out to be a good way to reduce cheating and oath-breaking. Another helpful cultural innovation, according to Atran and Henrik, are gods who administer collective punishment. When people believe that the gods might bring drought or pestilence on the whole village for the adultery of two people, you can bet that the villagers will be much more vigilant for and gossipy about any hint of an extramarital liaison. Angry gods make shame more effective as a means of social control. Atran and Henrik begin with the same claim about byproducts as do the New Atheists. But because these anthropologists see groups as real entities that have long been in competition, they are able to see the role that religion plays in helping some groups to win that competition. There is now a great deal of evidence that religions do, in fact, help groups to cohere, solve free rider problems, and win the competition for group-level survival. The clearest evidence comes from the anthropologist Richard Sosis, who examined the history of 200 communes founded in the United States in the 19th century. Communes are natural experiments in cooperation without kinship. Communes can survive only to the extent that they can bind a group together, suppress self-interest, and solve the free rider problem. Communes are usually founded by a group of committed believers who reject the moral matrix of the broader society and want to organize themselves along different principles. For many 19th century communes, the principles were religious. For others, they were secular, mostly socialist. Which kind of commune survived longer? Sosis found that the difference was stark. Just 6% of the secular communes were still functioning 20 years after their founding, compared to 39% of the religious communes. What was the secret ingredient that gave the religious communes a longer shelf life? Sosis quantified everything he could find about life in each commune. He then used those numbers to see if any of them could explain why some stood the test of time while others crumbled. He found one master variable: the number of costly sacrifices that each commune demanded from its members. It was things like giving up alcohol and tobacco, fasting for days at a time, conforming to a communal dress code or hairstyle, or cutting ties with outsiders. For religious communes, the effect was perfectly linear. The more sacrifice a commune demanded, the longer it lasted. But Sosis was surprised to discover that demands for sacrifice did not help secular communes. Most of them failed within 8 years, and there was no correlation between sacrifice and longevity. Why doesn't sacrifice strengthen secular communes? Sosis argues that rituals, laws, and other constraints work best when they are sacralized. He quotes the anthropologist Roy Rappaport: "To invest social conventions with sanctity is to hide their arbitrariness in a cloak of seeming necessity." But when secular organizations demand sacrifice, every member has a right to ask for a cost-benefit analysis, and many refuse to do things that don't make logical sense. In other words, the very ritual practices that the New Atheists dismiss as costly, inefficient, and irrational turn out to be a solution to one of the hardest problems humans face: cooperation without kinship. Irrational beliefs can sometimes help the group function more rationally, particularly when those beliefs rest upon the sanctity foundation. Sacredness binds people together and then blinds them to the arbitrariness of the practice. Sosis's findings support Atran and Henrik. Gods really do help groups cohere, succeed, and outcompete other groups. This is a form of group selection, but Atran and Henrik say it's purely cultural group selection. Religions that do a better job of binding people together and suppressing selfishness spread at the expense of other religions, but not necessarily by killing off the losers. Religions can spread faster than genes, as in the case of Islam in the 7th and 8th centuries, or Mormonism in the 19th century. A successful religion can be adopted by neighboring people or by vanquished populations. Atran and Henrik therefore doubt that there has been any genetic evolution for religiosity. Moralistic high gods are just too recent, they say, having emerged along with agriculture in the last 10,000 years. Atran and Henrik believe that gene-culture coevolution happened slowly during the Pleistocene, when the modules were forged that later produced gods as byproducts. By the time humans left Africa, the genes were set, and the rest is all culture. Atran and Henrik join the New Atheists in claiming that our minds were not shaped, tuned, or adapted for religion. But now that we know how quickly genetic evolution can occur, I find it hard to imagine that the genes stood still for more than 50,000 years. How could the genetic partner in the swirling waltz of gene-culture coevolution not take a single step as the cultural partner began dancing to religious music? 50,000 years may not be enough time to evolve a complex new module, such as the hypersensitive agency detector or the hive switch, from scratch. But how could there be no optimizing, no fine-tuning of modules to make people more prone to adaptive forms of hiving, sacralizing, or godding, and less prone to self-destructive or group-destructive forms? The Durkheimian Story: Byproducts, Then Maypoles. David Sloan Wilson, a biologist at Binghamton University, was the most vigorous protester at the trial, conviction, and banishment of group selection in the 1970s. He then spent 30 years trying to prove that group selection was innocent. He produced mathematical demonstrations that genetic group selection could indeed occur under special conditions that might well have been the conditions of earlier human societies. And then he did the difficult cross-disciplinary work of exploring the history of many religions to see if they truly provided those special conditions. Wilson's great achievement was to merge the ideas of the two most important thinkers in the history of the social sciences, Darwin and Durkheim. Wilson showed how they complete each other. He begins with Darwin's hypothesis about the evolution of morality by group selection, and he notes Darwin's concern about the free rider problem. He then gives Durkheim's definition of religion as a unified system of beliefs and practices that unites members into one single moral community. If Durkheim is right that religions create cohesive groups that can function like organisms, then it supports Darwin's hypothesis. Tribal morality can emerge by group selection. And if Darwin is right that we are products of multi-level selection, including group selection, then it supports Durkheim's hypothesis. We are homo duplex, designed by natural selection, to move back and forth between the lower, individual, and higher, collective, levels of existence. In his book, Darwin's Cathedral, Wilson catalogs the ways that religions have helped groups cohere, divide labor, work together, and prosper. He shows how John Calvin developed a strict and demanding form of Christianity that suppressed free riding and facilitated trust and commerce in 16th century Geneva. He shows how medieval Judaism created cultural fortresses that kept outsiders out and insiders in. But his most revealing example, based on research by the anthropologist Stephen Lansing, is the case of water temples among Balinese rice farmers in the centuries before Dutch colonization. Rice farming is unlike any other kind of agriculture. Rice farmers must create large irrigated paddies that they can drain and fill at precise times during the planting cycle. It takes a cast of hundreds. In one region of Bali, rainwater flows down the side of a high volcano through rivulets and rivers in the soft volcanic rock. Over several centuries, the Balinese carved hundreds of terraced pools into the mountainside and irrigated them with an elaborate series of aqueducts and tunnels, some running underground for more than a kilometer. At the top of the whole system, near the crest of the volcano, they built an immense temple for the worship of the goddess of the waters. They staffed the temple with 24 full-time priests, selected in childhood, and a high priest who was thought to be the earthly representative of the goddess herself. The lowest level of social organization was the subak, a group of several extended families that made decisions democratically. Each subak had its own small temple with its own deities, and each subak did the hard work of rice farming more or less collectively. But how did the subaks work together to build the system in the first place? And how do they maintain it and share its waters fairly and sustainably? These sorts of commons dilemmas, where people must share a common resource without depleting it, are notoriously hard to solve. The ingenious religious solution to this problem of social engineering was to place a small temple at every fork in the irrigation system. The god in each such temple united all the subaks that were downstream from it into a community that worshipped that god, thereby helping the subaks to resolve their disputes more amicably. This arrangement minimized the cheating and deception that would otherwise flourish in a zero-sum division of water. The system made it possible for thousands of farmers, spread over hundreds of square kilometers, to cooperate without the need for central government, inspectors, and courts. The system worked so efficiently that the Dutch, who were expert hydrologists themselves, could find little to improve. What are we to make of the hundreds of gods and temples woven into this system? Are they just byproducts of mental systems that were designed for other purposes? Are they